Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with translator Susan Bernofsky, whose latest translation is Memoirs of a Polar Bear by Yoko Tawada. We'll also hear from poet Stacey Ann Balkin, whose new books are Jackalope Girl Learns to Speak and The Lost City Museum. One of my New Year's resolutions was to read more fiction in translation. Sometimes I think there's a whole world of great literature out there, and we rely on skilled, devoted translators to bring it to us. I started with a wonderful novel called Memoirs of a Polar Bear by Yoko Tawada, and noticed that the woman who translated the book from German is New Orleanian Susan Bernofsky. She directs the literary translation program at the Columbia University School of the Arts, and she is one of the leading translators of German language literature. It's a real pleasure to have a chance to talk with her about her work. Susan Bernofsky, thanks so much, and welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. I'm so thrilled to be talking to my hometown.
Now, you were kind of a child prodigy with literary translation, weren't you? You started at a very young age.
Oh, that's an exaggeration. No, I started in high school, which, you know, I went to NOCA, which I know you know all about.
Yes.
And like all the students there, we were writing and some of us were translating too. It was just part of the curriculum.
So how did you become interested in it in the first place? What was the first thing you translated? Do you remember?
I can't remember if it was some German, I think it was Grimm's Fairy Tale, but I started on Walser early too because he was one of the authors that was on our syllabus at NOCA. But I had started studying German, you know, I also went to Ben Franklin as my academic school and did some translations also in the context of class there. I studied with a wonderful teacher named Julia Schuller, who just inspired me so much.
So tell us a little bit about Robert Walser. You're not only translating his work, you're working on a biography of him as well, right?
Indeed I am. I was writing it earlier this morning. So in my book right now, he has just turned 21 years old. he's going to be 78, so you can tell how far along I am in this bag. Oops, don't tell my editor. But, you know, he's somebody whose work just captivated me right from the beginning. He's so playful, imaginative. I love how he tells stories. I love his way of looking at the world and writing these just sentences that just blow your mind over and over again. He's just... If you're out there and you haven't read Robert Walser, go get something by him. He's just so fun to read and joyful. And, you know, his own life had plenty of darkness in it. And he found a way to not screen over that, but to turn it to incredibly heartfelt and sincere and delightful, beautiful literary works. He's just really something. And there's lots of great short stories by him. There's novels.
I'm curious, are all of them translated now, or is there work left to be done there?
So all four of his novels, whose manuscripts have survived, there were some he wrote that the manuscripts were lost and we don't have, unfortunately. And so I'm still thinking, will one of them maybe come to light after all? But of his short fiction, there's still quite a bit to be translated. I'd say maybe two-fifths of it is left to translate at this point. So.
Well, you better get to work. No. So yeah. How different is it for you, you know, after you've spent all this time? Because I think translation is like an act of devotion and service to the book. You know, it's like service to a greater good. Mm-hmm. So what's it like for you to make that shift from translator to biographer?
Oh, it's been interesting. Because all of a sudden, you know, I'm not looking at, like, the sentence in terms of, like, how can I possibly capture the shape of this amazing sentence in English? But instead I'm thinking, wait, what clues does the sentence contain about what he was doing and where he was at this moment? You know, there's a story of his called Lake Greifen, which I translated a long time ago. It's appeared in the first book I ever published as a translator called Masquerade and Other Stories, which came out in 1990. But in that story, on the walk, the narrator says hello to some reapers. And because they're reapers, I know what season it is. And because of that, it's helping me guess in the biography that he was in Zurich in June 1899, which is a relevant fact for my biography. So everything's turning into detective work in a really fun way.
Oh, it sounds like detective work. Just deductive reasoning and all that.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know, how do you decide to take on translation projects? Do you pursue books that you read in German that you love, or do you wait for publishers to bring them to you?
Well, usually the way it happens is that publishers, you know, buy the translation rights to a book and then seek out a translator for the book, and that's really the standard way that books get translators. Because I've worked with one publisher in New York, New Directions, you know, I'm now in a position where I can bring a book to them and say, hey, maybe you've never heard of this book, but I think it's fantastic, and can we think about doing it? It almost never happens, though, because the publishers have very busy publishing schedules, and it's hard for them to sort of add a new book to it. Also, for a publisher, it's such a big investment to publish a translated book. You know, there is some grant subsidies available for them, but they're paying the foreign rights, they're paying the translation costs, and then all the regular costs of publishing a book. So they're not going to take on a book unless they're really convinced that they can sell it to their readership.
How do you think publishers decide when it's time for a new translation? You know, every now and then, there'll just be a new translation come along of a work, and you think, well, what was I reading before? You know?
Publishers, I hate to put it so bluntly, are businesses, and very often a publisher will decide that they want to publish a new translation of a classic work because they think it is a moment where they can sell a new translation, or a translation will add prestige to the publisher's program. You know, Penguin getting Lydia Davis to retranslate Proust or Madame Bovary. These are prestige items for the publishing house also. And so it has to do with marketing. I have never had the experience of a publisher saying, oh, yes, I have been studying all the older translations and they're not quite up to snuff. Oh, wait, exception. New York Review Books Classics, Edwin Frank does that. He actually does go and look at the old translations and think, no, we need a new one. So there are publishers who do that. I think the more commercial houses are thinking about what they can sell.
So what's the process like when you take on a book? Like, say you're doing a Jenny Urban Beck novel. So what do? Do you read it in the original language like a couple of times and then begin, or how do you work that?
Well, it's not actually necessary to have read the book before you translate it, because in the course of translating it, you're going to go through several drafts, in my case, four drafts. And so my rough draft of the book is in a way like the first read-through, because for me the second draft is the business draft where I really get down to it. But in practical terms, I usually have always read the book before I sit down to translate it, just because, you know, usually there's a gap of a couple of years between when the book came out in German and it's coming out in English. And, you know, one of my authors has a new book, I want to read it right away. So I've pretty much always read the book before. But really, translating is a different sort of reading. It's a more, you know, nuts and bolts reading. I translated a horror novel a few years ago, The Black Spider by Jeremias Gotthelf, 19th century Swiss writer. And it is so terrifying, and I had actually read it twice before, and it terrified me so badly. But then when I sat down to translate it, it wasn't scary at all, because I was looking at it mechanically, sentence by sentence, and how is the sentence working? And suddenly the scariness of it vanished. But if I go back and read it again now, just reading it, it will scare me again.
That's a wonderful story. Now, I want you to talk a little bit about Memoirs of a Polar Bear, which I just love. The author, Yoko Tawada, was born in Japan and writes in German. So were you dealing with something that was more than usually complicated linguistically?
Well, her work is everything on the spectrum of linguistic complexity is on there. Because, you know, an earlier book of hers, The Naked Eye, she wrote half in German and half in Japanese, like one chapter in one and one chapter in the other. And then she went back and forth and translated the chapters into the other language so that she had two finished manuscripts. And that, it's just linguistically a hodgepodge. And actually, Memoirs of a Polar Bear, for the first time ever for her, she wrote the book entirely in Japanese and then sat down and made a German version. And she told the publisher then that she wanted us to translate from the German and not from the Japanese in this case, because, as she said, I have already moved the book from an Eastern language to a Western language for you. If you translate the German, it will be more my intention.
Ah.
And that is so interesting, because conventional wisdom is you always translate the original, and the more original, unoriginal, the better. And she's completely blown up this idea of what an original is, But she also writes books that are translated from Japanese. I mean, I hear that she has a new novel in Japanese about the Fukushima tragedy, and that's going to be translated.
Interesting. So tell us a little bit about these three bears.
I love them. This is one of my favorite books that I ever did. So, okay, there are three bears. It is a family saga in that it's generational, you know, grandson, mother, grandmother, if you want to put it like that, although the book is, there's a little slippage. You're not sure exactly how many generations are inside these three generations. So they're bears. They move and live in human society. They interact with human beings. And the book acts as if there is no contradiction between their moving in human society and their physical reality as polar bears, which they do maintain. So the book is very straight-faced about this, which is incredibly funny. And the sort of deadpan approach to the animal-human rift, as it were, it lets this book be about so many other things. So it winds up being, you know, about ethnicity, about otherness, about othering others, about race. You know, one of the polar bears goes to a party and someone touches his hair. Classic microaggression. And it's so playful, but it's about all these really serious things.
And they're writers. I mean...
Yeah, one polar bear is a writer. And another one is a trained dancer and actress. And she
has
a role she likes, so she takes a job in a circus. So then you have the idea of, you know, animals in circuses as workers, and there's other polar bears in the circus who form a union.
I love that. And where do polar bears truly belong? What is their true home?
Indeed.
It's so fascinating. But I have to tell you, you know, I was reading along at the very beginning, and you had me at paw hand.
Oh, you like the paw?
I love the paw hand translation.
In German, you can make compounds more easily than in English. The German language is very compound friendly. And so Pfotenhand, paw hand, in German, it sticks out a little less than the English paw hand, but not much less.
Oh,
yeah, there
no.
were a lot of conversations in editing. Can we get away with this paw hand? And we decided, yes, paw hand.
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. That's how I knew I was truly in her world. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, she knows she's talking to a human audience. And so it's like the polar bear authoress is translating paw into paw hand so that her human readers will be able to follow her.
Oh, no. Well done, Susan. That's all I can say.
Thank you. Everything about this book is so joyful. It's about all these serious things, but like just the joy on every page of it. It's a book about global warming, too. And it's
beautiful,
but it's somehow, I don't know, the book, it winds up being a very happy book, even though it's about all these sad subjects.
I know. A friend of mine said, oh, those polar bears are so charming. They are. Well, it's so interesting. You know, you talk about the infinite buffet of books, and it's so true, you know. And I think one of the really satisfying things for you must have been finding a way to pay it forward.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, when I was growing up, I loved reading books from all over the world. It, you know, made me feel like I was just able to experience life elsewhere. And I had, you know, as a teenager especially, I had this fantasy life that was so deeply rooted in books, and I was very escapist, you know, the world around me. What's the next book I can read? And so having experienced an incredible love of reading as a kid and having profited from all these international books that were available to me, sure. And, you know, really when I started translating more actively, I went through college, my whole education, you know, the whole time I was planning to be a writer when I grew up. But I kept translating on the side because I would see a writer that I really liked and thought, oh, I want my friends to be able to read this. You know, let me tell you this story. Oh, I have to translate it first. Okay, I'll do a quick translation. Now, Yoko Tawada is somebody that I started translating, I think it was in 1992, because I was in Germany and happened to buy a copy of a literary magazine from Austria called Manuskripte, and there was a short story by her in there called Das Fremde aus der Dose, in English, canned foreign. And I saw this little two-page story and thought, this is magnificent, I love it so much, and I sat down and translated it and sent it to the author, care of the magazine, saying, you know, I was in my early 20s then. Hi, I'm Susan. I translated this story. Is it okay with you if I try and get it published? And Yoko Tawada immediately wrote back to me and said, fantastic, you've translated my story. Here's another one. Can you translate this too?
And you know, 24 years later, here you are.
Yeah.
That's an amazing thing. Oh, well, we've been talking with the award-winning translator Susan Bernofsky, whose most recent translated work is Memoirs of a Polar Bear by Yoko Tawada. Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was great talking to you, Susan.
Well, I'm a polar bear, and my name is Bjorn, and I've been a polar bear since the day I was born. Welcome to my kingdom and the world that I roam, the circumpolar Arctic, a place that I call home.
It's a great pleasure to welcome poet Stacy Balkin to The Reading Life. She's a Writing Center tutor at Delgado Community College and is the author of two books, Jackalope Girl Learns to Speak and The Lost City Museum. Great titles, wonderful work. Stacy Balkin, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan. I'm so excited to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. Now, I see from your work that you're from Piscataway, New Jersey.
Yes,
and you studied poetry at Rutgers and at California State University of Fresno. So what favorable winds blew you our way to New Orleans?
After Rutgers, when I graduated, I moved down here. A friend's dad lived here, and he moved down, and I kept coming to visit him and drove down when he moved down and couldn't stay away. So that was my first stop, was I lived in a shared artist house here for 1 year. And then decided I would like to get a master's and see a little bit more of the world before coming back to what I felt was home.
Ah, so you knew it was home even then.
Yes.
So you found it a good community, a good place for your work.
Absolutely. There's so much writing here. I mean, right now we're on a weekly show about and for writers, which I have not found many other places.
Oh, well, that's very nice. Thank you very much. So first, let's talk about Jackalope Girl Learns to Speak. The idea is so captivating, as is the cover, with these antlers adorned with beautiful flowers. But when you think about it, being a jackalope girl is really something very complicated.
Yes. It started as sort of an idea within my friends. We all had animal names for each other. There was the flamingo, the otter, and when it came to me, I said, what animal am I? And they named me the jackalope. They said, well, you look so sweet, and you're like a very bunny-like creature. But if you get crossed, the antlers come out and you turn into a tough cookie. So I ran with that. I was adopted from birth, and it was always a very open thing in my family, but not something we spoke about a lot. So it was difficult to write. I had no way to enter that topic. So by sort of imagining this fabulous narrative with these half animal, half people characters, it gave me that freedom to go into those details that were a little harder to get to using the real world.
And this sustained you for a long time. I mean, this is a substantial poetry sequence that you've created here.
Oh, thank you. It came very quickly. It was a very strange, I had one poem, and from there I wrote a second poem, and then I think within a matter of weeks, the rest came. It was very odd. I've never written like that before.
Wow. That's a sign that it's meant to be, you know. I believe that.
The community has really welcomed it in a way I didn't expect. And there's a lot of women's writing out there that works in a similar vein. It's not in my bio yet, but Catherine Moore and I are working on editing an anthology of domestic fabulist women's work. And we have almost 700 submissions. We'd never expected such a turnout, but it's really important, this magical, real world of poetry.
Oh, absolutely. Now, one strand I notice in both your books, in Jackalope Girl Learns to Speak and The Lost City Museum, is that you're drawn to the surrealists, particularly Leonora Carrington, right?
Yes.
So talk about how that visual inspiration works for you.
The surrealist visuals can open up a lot for the written word, because it offers a sort of freedom to let go and be crazy and not worry about making sense, which is a much easier way to get at some of those difficult situations and emotions through poetry, at least.
That's almost as free as you can be, really, don't you think?
Absolutely.
I mean, they're so amazing. Now, you also are inspired by cities, as am I. In Jackalope Girl, you often speak of the animal city. And in the Lost City Museum, you write about other cities, Pompeii, Carthage, Atlantis. What inspires you about that idea? Why do they call to you as muses?
I think cities offer a surreal landscape in a way, because they're ever changing. There's as much history as you decide to look for. And it's pastoral in its own way, but maybe the anti-pastoral, because many of the cities are through research and inspired by specific images. The Pompeii poem, for example, was inspired by an article about uncovering these bodies that were trapped in the ash since Pompeii, just in a recent article. So there's a history that you can dig into just by mentioning a city name. I mean, the town I grew up in wasn't a city, but I name it a city in a poem just because it offers such a structure for the reader to take.
Why don't you read that poem for us now? The name of my old city. It's about your hometown of Piscataway?
Yes.
And so let's hear that one.
The name of my old city. The name of my old city is a bone rattle. Too many syllables and vowels hit short and sharp as vertebrae. From Indian trails to interstate, Piscataway. I remember learning to spell it, the letters like native figures etched into a brick wall. It has nothing to do with water. I collect seashells, starfish, meerschaum. The artifacts in my exhibit were once alive, an exception to the arrowheads and muskets on permanent display in the small glass case at City Hall. This sprawled city is reined in by the turnpike, the parkway, and a swift river rushing as the sharp breaths we take in, our fear of heavy rains. That's because my city floods.
Well, that's something we can certainly relate to living here, too, you know?
Yes, in a different way, but
very
yes.
much so. And there are so many museums in this book. The idea of a museum really appeals to you as well. You have the Church Museum in Hawaii, the Tattoo Museum, the Mermaid Museum, which I especially love.
Talk about
creating those mental museums.
Well, there's something appealing to me in the language of exhibit, how in a museum, each artifact is mounted separately, but it's meant to be part of a larger whole. When you walk through it, you see the narrative, but separately it might not show through. So to me, that seemed an appealing way to organize a book because each poem is sort of dealing with one specific little thing, but altogether, I think it creates a museum of this sort of static imagery, creating a moving narrative.
And you go from Piscataway to great cities, you know, and there's no way you can mention Atlantis without someone having a strong mental image or some memory or thought about that particular place. But I wonder if you'd read the Tattoo Museum for us. That was one of my very favorites.
Oh, sure. So the Tattoo Museum is a real place in New Orleans. I've yet to go to it, but once I heard it existed, I imagined, I don't know, people with tattoos in a museum. So this is Tattoo Museum. Past the velvet ropes hung across the lobby, we become exhibits of flexing biceps, ligaments swollen beneath inked skin and rolled up pants legs, our stories on display. The skull and roses of my shoulder fold into the garden blossoming on your chest. A family of ticket holders stops to watch from the gift shop as we trace fingers across each other's murals, a compass, a ship's wheel, a finch. Together, too alive to be mannequin, no matter how public this private life of ours may feel. The lights flick to signal closing time, but before I slip on my shoes, you sketch a map across my feet. I draw a heart around the name of our city.
I love that. Cities again.
Thank you.
Now, I was intrigued to learn that you were once an artist in residence at the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. So what was that like for you? What kind of inspiration did you find there?
It was fantastic. I had a month in a cabin in the mountains just to write and lead a workshop. It came at a very strange time for me. As we were driving to the Smokies to start the residence, I found out my father was in the hospital, so I ended up zooming right past it and going and spending a month in New Jersey instead. The Smoky Mountains were great, and they let me delay the trip for a couple weeks. So by the time I got there, it was more about needing space for myself in nature than needing inspiration to write. I had plenty.
Of course.
And that's sort of when I turned to the Surrealist. I actually brought a book of Dalí with me. And most of the poems I wrote on that residency came from examining those landscapes that many of the poems are in Lost City Museum that I wrote on that trip. So many of them were inspired more by false landscapes than the actual mountains there in a very strange way.
Interesting.
But a month with the surrealist.
A month waking up, hiking, coming back, looking at paintings and writing. It was crucial to this book. Crucial.
Well, that's why I love this book. It is so visual. It draws you right into it. You feel like you've been to a museum after you've read it.
Oh, thank you. So that's what I was hoping for.
We've been talking with poet Stacy Balkan, whose new books are Jackalope Girl Learns to Speak and The Lost City Museum. You can meet her at this year's Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival later on in March. Stacy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. This has been great.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Pamela Arsenault discusses her new book, Guidebooks to Sin, The Blue Books of Storyville, New Orleans, Tuesday, February 7th at 6 at Octavia Books, then again in Maple Street Bookshop, Thursday, February 9th at 6. The New Orleans Museum of Art curator Russell Lord discusses Building a History of Photography, Clarence John Laughlin's collection, Wednesday, February 8th at 6 at the Historic New Orleans Collection, Williams Research Center. This is in conjunction with the exhibit Clarence John Laughlin and His Contemporaries. Kara Martinez Bachman discusses and signs Kissing the Crisis, Field Notes of Foul-Mouthed Babies, Disenchanted Women, and Careening into Middle Age, Wednesday, February 8th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. The Garden District Bookshop Book Club discusses The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins, Wednesday, February 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Carl Brasso and Donald Davis present Ain't There No More, Louisiana's Disappearing Coastal Plain, Thursday, February 9th at 6 at Octavia Books. Lisa Carey discusses and signs her thriller, The Stolen Child, Thursday, February 9th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses Nine Fox Gambit by Yoon-Ha Lee, Saturday, February 11th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Brian Costello discusses and signs Carnival in Louisiana, celebrating Mardi Gras from the French Quarter to the Red River, Sunday, February 12th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. The Maple Street Bookshop Book Club discusses The Interestings by Meg Wolitzer, Monday, February 13th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Molly Polda of the Newcomb College Institute facilitates this discussion, and Wolitzer appears March 6th at Tulane University as the Zale Kimmerling Writer in Residence. Stephanie Garber discusses her young adult novel, Caraval, Tuesday, February 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. And coming up, the Friends of the Terrebonne Parish Public Library sponsor the 14th Annual Jambalaya Writers Conference, set for March 4th at the Terrebonne Parish Main Library in Houma. Writers across all genres will guide both new and practiced writers in their craft. This year features Lisa Unger, Jeff Lindsay, author of the Dexter novels, Rachel Kane, romance writers Alexandria Weiss and Farah Roshan, Roland Paris of Marvel Comics, My Sunshine Away author Emma Walsh, Nicholas Maneri, Ashley Elston, Elise Arden, Kim Vaz DeVille, and many more. Poetry and fiction contest submissions are due by February 10th, and for more information or to register, go to mytpl.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.